listeners for listening to us on iRed English Radio. This is Viewpoints. For more information, visit our website at parstoday.com/en. Also visit our YouTube channel and Instagram page, Color of Islam Radio. To another episode, God bless you. Fi amanillah.
The same when I'm too concerned by what they say. Why should I when I have you to doubt you would be the worst mistake? Deep inside I know amidst all the darkness and everything which makes no sense, know that you exist. Guides me through my darkest nights, shows me right from wrong. A world that often lies, cause I don't need anyone, anything in life but you. No, I don't need anyone to show me my way. No, I don't need anyone but you.
Communicate. At first, they merely suggested it. Now, they've done it. Hezbollah has successfully imported fuel from Iran into Lebanon. Lebanon has been suffering from a deepening economic crisis for almost 2 years now, with power cuts, food shortages, fuel shortages, and total devaluation of its currency. The whole point behind importing the fuel to try and mitigate this. Now, some argue that the shipment undermines Lebanese sovereignty. Others argue it's a victory for the resistance front, with people waving flags in celebration of the fuel's arrival. So why is this shipment so controversial? Has it helped mitigate Lebanon's economic crisis? And how does it affect the overall geopolitical landscape of the Middle East, when Syria, Iran, Hezbollah are all able to successfully bypass U.S. sanctions? I'm Richard Medhurst, and this is The Communique. Lebanon has been suffering from a severe economic crisis for almost 2 years now. Many factors have contributed to this, one being the political instability, the lack of a central government. Lebanon has only just recently been able to form a new government. Another is corruption. It's widespread, the so-called Ponzi scheme that has been going on for decades and is central to Lebanon's economy. The global pandemic with COVID-19, not to mention the Beirut port explosion, both these things have made everything worse for Lebanon. Moreover, the war next door in Syria has also impacted the country severely, and vice versa, given how closely Syria and Lebanon's economies are interlinked. And last but not least, the external pressure on Lebanon from the West to try and exclude Hezbollah from the political process. All these things combined have led to a terrible situation where the Lebanese pound, or lira, has lost more than 90% of its value since October 2019. Lebanon's situation is so bad, Bloomberg reports that Lebanon's annual inflation rate is now the highest in the world, surpassing Zimbabwe and Venezuela. The result of this is that three-quarters of Lebanon's population now lives in poverty. Prescription and over-the-counter medicine alike are either unavailable or too expensive. Al Jazeera reports that on average, food items today cost 10 times more than what they did in 2019. The price of milk has increased sevenfold, rice 19-fold, cooking oil is 37 times more expensive. The World Food Program says that food prices have risen by 557% since 2019. Just to buy bread for one family, someone earning minimum wage would have to spend 44%, basically half, of their monthly salary. Lebanon is a country that imports 80% of its food, and right now, the food situation is further imperiled by fuel shortages and power cuts. The government just cannot supply people with enough electricity, so people either have no electricity, or most of the day they have to rely instead on private generators. Things like bakeries, for example, need diesel fuel to keep their generators running so they can stay open. But because there isn't enough fuel, instead they have to close, making bread scarce. The power cuts are so severe, people only have electricity for 4 hours, sometimes 2 hours a day. Not just bakeries, but hospitals and essential services have also warned that they are on the brink of collapse as they lack power and electricity to keep functioning. Ironically, even during parliamentary session, the power also went out, which Hezbollah offered to fix by bringing two generators. One of the guests joining me today from Beirut, his internet and electricity cut out in the middle of the interview as we were talking about these power cuts. The suffering of the people in Lebanon is widespread. Scenes like this are typical in Beirut. People queuing up for bread, people queuing up for fuel, hours at a time to try and get something if they're lucky. In August, the central bank announced that it can no longer afford to subsidize fuel. The problem of liquidity plagues Lebanon still, as there is a shortage of foreign currency, especially US dollars. While officially, the Lebanese pound is pegged to the US dollar at a rate of 1,500 liras, the black market rate has done nothing but skyrocket with no end in sight. Currently, the rate hovers at around 15,000 Lebanese pounds to the dollar. Basic necessities are either too expensive for people to afford or simply not there. Joining me is Abbas Bazzi, Lebanese political activist and commentator. He's also a board member of the Al Awra organization. Thank you for coming on the show, Abbas. Could you maybe describe to us the economic situation in Lebanon in practical terms, what the crisis is like for everyday people?
Yeah, it's bad. I mean, it's always been tough. I guess it's gotten worse over the last couple of years since the economy tanked a couple of years ago. But now it seems like it's bottomed out, and things are getting really tough for the average Lebanese citizen. What happened is with the devaluation of the Lebanese lira, for a long time, from like I would say from 1997 forward, it was pegged at 1,500, and that sort of stabilized things for a while. But since the economic collapse of a couple of years ago, it went up to about 7,000, 8,000, and finally went up to about, the lowest was about 18,000. Now it's gone down to about 15,000. And it's tough because most people who work there, especially the ones that work for the government, get paid in lira, and their salary is the same. So if a person was getting paid, say like a million liras a month, which, prior to the economic collapse, would translate to roughly around $700, they're still getting paid a million liras, and now it's not worth $700 anymore. It's basically trying to live on $100 a month. So imagine trying to sustain a family on $100 a month. It's tough, and you couple that with a pandemic, and now you have the fuel shortage. I mean, Lebanon's always had a problem providing electricity for its citizens. Outside of Beirut, most people would get like 8 to 10 hours of electricity per day. Now it's down to about 1 hour. And there's a shortage of gasoline at the gas stations. People are waiting in long lines to purchase. Just like they can't even fill up their gas tanks. They could probably get like a quarter tank or half a tank. So yeah, things have gotten really, really tough recently.
The government raised the price of fuel. Why did they do that after the first shipment arrived?
They didn't really raise up the price. What happened is they removed the subsidies for fuel, which consequently rose the price up. And the reason for that is because they claimed that they didn't have the funds to subsidize it anymore.
When we talk about a de facto American siege on Lebanon, what does one understand by this term? What role exactly is the United States playing in Lebanese politics?
Yeah, as far as the American siege on Lebanon, yeah, I mean, basically, for the past couple of decades, the U.S. has done everything it can to try to break the resistance of Lebanon, and it has used, I wouldn't even call them allies of the U.S., they're just pawns of the U.S., the politicians in Lebanon that the U.S. props up to try to disarm Hezbollah, which they don't have the political clout or the means to do that. But it's like the U.S. uses them and they use the U.S. So basically it came to a situation to where the U.S. had no more cards to play. And now after Hezbollah broke the siege, now the U.S. is trying to, you know, play the role of, well, we can bring in gasoline from Egypt, fuel from Egypt, and we can bring electricity from Jordan, which the U.S. is basically breaking U.S. laws because, as you know, the Caesar Act on Syria. So now the U.S. is forced to deal with Syria to, you know, try to, you know, save face in Lebanon.
The Lebanese Prime Minister Miqati said that the fuel shipments are a, quote, violation of Lebanese sovereignty. What do you make of that exactly? Why do you think he said that?
Yeah, I heard that. That was funny. It was hilarious, actually. I mean, what sovereignty is he talking about? Since when has Lebanon been a sovereign country? I mean, Lebanon was literally, you know, created through Sykes-Picot, not to have any sort of sovereignty, just to weaken, you know, our people in the region, but to you know, to divide us. And Lebanon has never had any sort of sovereignty. So I'd like to know what's that. I mean, every political power in Lebanon is basically beholden to some sort of external power. So which sovereignty is he talking about that was violated? I mean, if there are some sovereign powers in Lebanon, let them bring fuel. I mean, we're out of, you know, the country's out of fuel. Bring fuel to Lebanon. Show us your sovereignty. Show us your ability. Bring fuel to the country. So this, I mean, this was an act of desperation by Hezbollah. I mean, it got to a point to where it was a national emergency. So if there's any kind of sovereignty that he's talking about, you know, to bring the sovereignty to the table and, you know, bring fuel to the country.
So Abbas, just as a last question to follow up, this whole situation in Lebanon, what do you think will finally remedy it? What would you like to see happen for things to get better?
Boy, I don't know. I mean, long-term, who knows? I mean, like, all these things that are right now, they're all, you know, short-term band-aids. Long-term, I mean, is that possible anytime soon? I'm not sure. I honestly don't know what the long-term solution is. In my opinion, that's the best way for all of us to unite under, you know, one central entity. But I don't know if the, you know, the groundwork is there for that anytime soon. I think we need to look inward. You know, we need to stop relying on the West because, you know, we witness a lot of what will happen to you when you rely on the West. We mean nothing to them. We're expendable. They'll watch us, you know, starve. We're totally expendable. So we need to look inward and find our solutions among ourselves.
Abbas Bazzi, great speaking with you. Thanks so much for coming on.
You do a great job. Keep up the great work.
Back in June, Hezbollah Secretary General Sayed Hassan Nasrallah suggested the idea of importing Iranian fuel into Lebanon. And just by merely bringing this up, Iraq went ahead and doubled its supply of crude oil to Lebanon from 500,000 to 1 million tons a year, likely at the discretion of the United States. Although crude oil does not exactly fix Lebanon's problem, as they are in need of fuel. 2 months later, on August 19th, Nasrallah announced fuel shipments from Iran were secured and confirmed. Immediately, the Americans rushed and scrambled to try and stop them. The American ambassador to Lebanon, Dorothy Shia, called up the Lebanese president, Michel Aoun. She explained that the United States would offer an alternative plan to secure Lebanon's energy needs and that they did not need Iran and Hezbollah. The American ambassador floated this extraordinary plan, which involves taking gas from Egypt, electricity from Jordan, and then sending them through Syria to Lebanon. It's quite funny, honestly. The United States is so desperate to undermine Iran and Hezbollah, it is willing to go to such lengths and undertake this extremely complicated process involving four countries just to give Lebanon power. Well, that's great, right? I mean, where was this plan before? Where was the United States rushing to help Lebanon with this intricate idea? As you remember, Syria is under U.S. sanctions, the Caesar Act. And yet, despite that, the United States is still willing to work with Syria, a country it has been at war with and sanctioning for 10 years. Meanwhile, Iran doesn't need to convert anything. It's just bringing diesel and benzene, already refined and ready to go. Nasrallah announced that there would be four shipments of fuel from Iran to Lebanon. Most of this would be diesel with a little bit of benzene as well. Remember that there is a tanker war in the region. Israel has sabotaged and attacked numerous Iranian ships bringing fuel to Syria. The United States has also pirated oil from Iran, headed to Venezuela, simply stealing it and selling it off. Nasrallah issued a warning, saying that the ships are to be regarded as Lebanese soil the moment they set sail, and that any attack on them would be considered an attack on Lebanese sovereignty. And with that said, Two of the four ships have already arrived safely. The first ship docked on September 14th in the Syrian port of Banias. The diesel was offloaded into oil tankers and driven to the Lebanese border. And as part of the axis of resistance, Syria provided these trucks for free. President Assad sent the Syrian army to escort them and had all tariffs and taxes lifted. A convoy of 80 trucks carrying with them 4 million liters of fuel made the journey from Banias, and as they crossed over into Lebanon, scores of people lined the streets in celebration of their arrival, waving Syrian, Iranian, and Lebanese flags and holding up signs saying, "Thank you, Iran, thank you, Syria." In a more extravagant move, one person was so happy he decided to fire an RPG into the air to celebrate the fuel shipment. As Nasrallah had announced, the first shipment of fuel would be going to hospitals, nursing homes, the Lebanese Red Cross, special needs facilities, the fire department, and other essential services. 1 month's supply of fuel completely free of charge. The rest would be sold to everyone else later at below-cost, cheap rates with zero profit. A week after the first shipment had arrived, the second oil tanker docked in Banias on September 23rd at 10 p.m. local time, with the other two ships expected in the coming weeks or months. We'll be right back after this short break.
Communique is a program in which Richard Medhurst, the independent journalist and political commentator, gives his views of controversial issues of our time and interviews famous politicians and personalities. This program is broadcast every Sunday by IRIB English Radio.
Now, joining me to discuss this further is Lebanese critic and journalist Pierre Abissaoud, specialized in the literary, artistic, and cultural life of the Arab world. He has worked for many newspapers, such as Al Hayat and Al Safir, and co-founded numerous others. Currently, he serves as the deputy editor of Al Akhbar, a daily Arabic language newspaper. Pierre Abissaoud, thanks so much for joining me today. It's a pleasure to have you on. So Pierre, just to start off, how has this shipment of fuel affected Lebanon politically and economically?
Lebanon's economic situation is not just confined to the last months, during which the U.S. decided to starve the people and slap them with sanctions, like they did with Syria and the Caesar Act, with the encouragement of cartels controlling the distribution of fuel, or lack thereof, and not to mention the political stooges and pawns who work with the United States and Saudi Arabia in the hope that starving the people will create chaos and turn people's opinion against Hezbollah. But the last months mustn't be understood outside the context of the last 30 years, a system rooted in corruption and embezzlement of public funds. We are talking about a monetary system which is essentially a Ponzi scheme that depends on external support and funding, with a complete lack of any real agriculture or industry. So once the money stopped flowing into Lebanon, everything collapsed and small investors were robbed. Meanwhile, the 1% weren't affected. When Sayyid Hassan Nasrallah gave his address on the day commemorating Ashura, he warned the Israeli enemy to stay away from the ships coming to Lebanon, that they are to be considered Lebanese soil. This posed a huge challenge for the Americans. So in response, the American ambassador called President Owen and said, "All this gas in Egypt, we can help bring it to Lebanon." Even though people have been pushing for this idea for years, and the Americans always stood in the way. Not to mention the Caesar Act sanctions on Syria, which have prohibited anything going through Syrian territory. The U.S. ambassador now says, "We have no problem bringing gas and electricity from Egypt to Jordan, through Syria to Lebanon." So all of a sudden, the Americans and Saudis realize that this pressure they've been putting on Lebanon to try and prevent the formation of a government has backfired. It turns out the situation is benefiting Hezbollah, because Hezbollah are now seen as the ones who are trying to prevent the collapse of the country by bringing in fuel and medicine. So to try and put an end to this, suddenly you have a new government being formed after 13 months of sabotage from Saudi Arabia's pawns and the Americans and the French. All of a sudden, we can bring gas from Egypt through Jordan and Syria. Suddenly, they are fine with it coming through Syria. So you see, the arrival of these fuel shipments from Iran broke the siege and broke the political stalemate in Lebanon. It also helps fight all the profiteers who stole and smuggled goods and raise prices to rip people off.
When we saw the convoy of trucks arriving from Syria to Lebanon, they just seemed to be driving in broad daylight, and you know, no one standing in their way. How is that exactly?
Well, what does that tell you? That's all about the balance of power. And they, the Israelis and Americans, know this. If you look at what they are saying in the Zionist media, the Israelis claim that they are turning a blind eye to the fuel shipments because they pity the Lebanese people. But this is not true. If you look at the balance of power today in the region, with this tanker war going on with Iran in the Arabian Sea, the Israeli enemy has had its ships attacked and blown up on numerous occasions. So in this political climate, no one dares to come near the oil tankers in the sea, nor the trucks driven by Hezbollah. Officially, the fuel is coming from a country under sanctions, meaning Iran, and going to another country under sanctions. But these sanctions are a creation of these white American cowboys. These sanctions aren't legitimate, nor were they approved by the United Nations. Right now, Lebanon is weak and in need. Even people who have disagreements with Hezbollah don't care anymore. Right now, all they're saying is, we want fuel. Whether it comes from Iran or Mars, it doesn't matter. We want fuel. And Hezbollah answered the call of the Lebanese people, even those who oppose them. The blockade has been lifted, and the current balance of power shows that Hezbollah is able to counter the Israeli enemy and prevent virtually anyone interfering with the shipments coming from Iran through Syria.
And how do you feel about the United States' response to this whole situation?
America and its allies won't do anything. They won't dare touch these shipments, neither by sea nor by land. Right now, the United States, France, and Saudi Arabia plan on facing off with Hezbollah at the ballot box by influencing the elections in Lebanon and undermining the democratic electoral process. When it comes to the issue of fuel shipments, they have lost this battle. Despite all their attempts to sway public opinion, to claim that this fuel was stolen, sent to Syria, and then shipped back. Or when they said that Lebanese cars would not work with Iranian benzene. All sorts of absurd claims. They thought they could play on people's fears, that people who are hungry and desperate might fall for these rumors. But this didn't work. The siege on Lebanon has been lifted. Their plan to anger the public has fallen apart. Trying to turn public opinion against resistance, while people don't have any food or gas and so forth, this failed. So they will try to find another way to demonize the resistance during the upcoming elections. Ironically, the thing that I dislike the most about the Lebanese system is that it's a sectarian system, which I wish we could replace with a secular one. This is the thing that's ultimately going to stop America's attempts to undermine our political process.
Thank you so much for coming on the program. It's a pleasure speaking with you. Naturally, not everyone is happy about the arrival of this fuel. There are some critics who say that Hezbollah is undermining the state. But where is the state? There has been no central government in Lebanon for years, and people have no faith in the politicians. Also, what's wrong exactly with giving some hospitals and nursing homes free fuel? I mean, it's certainly not a long-term solution, but it is bringing help to those most in need, free of charge, no strings attached. And yet critics want to reduce it to a PR stunt? Who would risk four oil tankers and all this trouble, so many things possibly going wrong, just for a PR stunt? It's really funny watching the Western politicians and media speak in their usual colonial arrogance, fuming because independent, sovereign countries won't bend the knee to their illegal sanctions. The headlines read that Hezbollah has brought in fuel in defiance of U.S. sanctions. How dare they? The Washington Post said that Hezbollah is flexing its muscle, you know, as if they just imported nuclear weapons. Now, Senator Jim Risch, a Republican from Idaho, he serves as the ranking member on the Senate Foreign Relations Committee. In response to the arrival of Iranian fuel to Lebanon, he said that, quote, Lebanon's received U.S.-sanctioned Iranian fuel trucked in by Hezbollah through Syria is a disappointing sign for the future of Lebanon's accountability and democracy. U.S. sanctions must mean something. It's unnerving to see this administration not make that clear, unquote. I'm not sure if that's a threat, but no, the axis of resistance does not care about your sanctions. This latest development in Lebanon is surely remarkable for several reasons. The U.S. thought that by sanctioning Syria, it will get rid of Bashar al-Assad, and by sanctioning Lebanon, they will turn the people against Hezbollah. As the economic crisis worsened, Hezbollah imported fuel and medicine and helped people buy basic necessities at a low cost. This boosted their image and popularity as a result, to the point that even people who dislike Hezbollah don't really care that Hezbollah is bringing in the fuel. They just want relief from the economic crisis. So once the Americans, the Saudis, the French, and their friends realized that their plan of blaming all of Lebanon's woes and problems on Hezbollah and trying to turn public opinion against Hezbollah didn't work, once they realized that this is actually making Hezbollah look good, all of a sudden, after 13 months of political stalemate, you have the formation of a new government, just like that. All of a sudden, after years of trying to get gas from Egypt and electricity from Jordan, the US is okay with it. All of a sudden, after years of wars and sanctions against Syria, the US is willing to break its own laws and sanctions to run this through Syria? Amazing, right? It turns out all that you need to do to get progress in Lebanon is for Hezbollah to suggest an idea and do it first, and then suddenly everyone else will want to do it as well. The US is so desperate, it has backed itself into a political corner. Even in its own alternative plan with Egypt and Jordan, it has to involve Syria and break its own rules and violate its own sanctions to make it happen. Syria, by the way, has agreed to this, so in addition to providing trucks and letting the Iranian ships dock in Banias, Syria will help with this US plan. So it's essentially a win-win for Lebanon. And although these fuel shipments aren't a long-term solution, they can't fix all of Lebanon's problems, nonetheless, they are a victory for the resistance front. It shows that US hegemony and power in the Middle East is weakening. Iran, a country under US sanctions, sent fuel to Syria, also a country under US sanctions, which was then transported by Hezbollah's oil company, Al Amana, also under US sanctions, to Lebanon, itself under a de facto US siege. This is a historic shift in Middle Eastern geopolitics, and although they might not like it, what Hezbollah has done here is outmaneuver both its political rivals in Lebanon and internationally in a masterful game of chess. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Richard Medhurst, and this is The Communique.
انسان را مطمئن می کند ذکر خدا ذکر الله تطمئن القلوب.
Be aware, the hearts find rest in Allah's remembrance.
Spring of truth.
الله يا الله سبحان الله الله يا الله والحمد لله الله ولا إله
Dear brothers and sisters, you are listening to the Spring of Truth from IRIB English Radio. I invite you to listen to a short part of the book Sirr-i Salat, The Secret of Prayer, written by Imam Khomeini. The Qiyam and the recitation is the agent Tawheed. Iyaka na'budu is the returning of the servant to Allah toward the absolute annihilation. Because for each recitation and prostration and genuflection, there is a stage. Thus, Qiyam to the stage of agent Tawheed has been related, though it possesses the essential Tawheed and the attribute internally. And this the same words as the mystic utter about the names, attributes, verbs, and essence, though they consider each name as a collective comprehensive name in which the manifestation of the name is appeared. And the manifestation of the attribute and essential would be therein. And the same in namely attribute and the essential one.
A'udhu billahi minash shaitan rajim. Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Dear listeners, assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. And you are listening to Spring of Truth coming to you from IRIB English Radio. So stay tuned with us. I am your host, Abdullah Al Musawi, an Islamic researcher at the Seminary of Qom. We are looking at Imam Khomeini's point of view when it comes to Ashura. Imam Khomeini was quoted saying, if people could truly understand and make it understood by others what all this is about, the lamentation, the mournings, and the eulogies, and why such high divine reward for a drop of tear shed for Imam Hussein, they would not call us the weeping nation. Rather, they would call us the nation of epic action. Imam Hussein, he himself said, I only made this revolution to seek reform. So through these cries, through these gatherings, through these mournings, we are trying to create reform. And we did. And first of which, Imam Khomeini, he himself, he created this massive revolution, toppled the government, changed an entire world. Not just that, but the whole world is facing it. The whole world, they are just powerless to do anything against it. They are powerless to stop it. And why is that? Because they are crying for Imam al-Hussein.
Ya Hayyu Ya Qayyum, Ya Hayyu Ya Qayyum, Ya Hayyu Ya Qayyum, Ya Hayyu Ya Qayyum.
If it was just a matter of logic, you couldn't just read a book and stay at home. You can just, I don't know, read the Quran and stay at home. But the idea is that we come every year. Not only should we listen to the lecture, not only should we just learn, but we need to lament and cry and beat our chest and have these things and make them continue and live. At the time of the Imams, alayhim as-salam, when they were living under oppressive rulers, they couldn't do much. They couldn't preach and lecture. But they instructed their followers to sit and cry for Imam Hussein. That's it, just cry. Read a eulogy, beat your chest, cry for Imam Hussein, and keep it going. Keep that emotion flowing. Throughout this lamentation and this flowing of emotions, we got to have all these that we have today. All these lecturers, all these scholars standing on the pulpits. It's because of this crying. So don't just listen and go. Participate. Take a share in making sure that this continues to generations to come.
السلام عليكم ورحمة الله.
Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
Ma'arib provincial governor in Yemen's National Salvation Government, Major General Ali Muhammad Tayman, said the country's army troops and fighters from allied popular committees will establish full control over the entire district of the central province of Ma'arib in case Saudi-led militants refuse calls for a ceasefire in the strategic area. We'll prepare for you an article written by Karim Jaffery, an independent journalist and blogger, under the heading, Yemeni Government's Initiative for Ending War in Ma'arib. simultaneously with the appointment of the United Nations new envoy to Yemen, consultations as well as political and diplomatic pressures, and of course the United States and the UK's entreaty for an end to the war in Yemen, sustained themselves. The Yemeni Army and Popular Committee's extensive victories over the past 2 weeks have caused the American side to finally despair of stopping Ansarullah movement through military means and seek out another approach. It was for this reason that the White House's envoy for Yemen made several trips to the region over the recent weeks. She visited Riyadh and Muscat, meeting with the country's officials. The Saudi side practically fights for the Americans and lacks all internal inclination towards the continuation of the war. However, it is trying to exit while still saving its face. For the American side, the fate of the city of Ma'arib is very important, and it is engaging in the consultations for the same reason. Over the past 7 years, the British and the Americans did not spare any crime against the Yemeni nation, crimes of such enormity that just something slightly resemble them have happened in a country such as China or Russia. These countries would have had 7 or 8 resolutions issued against them and faced hundreds of condemnations on the part of the bogus Western human rights organizations. Nevertheless, all these pressures led nowhere, and starving the Yemeni people did not make them sell out their scruples. The West's heavy investment in Ma'arib province did not bring along any victory for them. Their direct interference in the war in the city showed that although they may be the bigger in numbers and have greater equipment at their disposal, they have nothing on the Yemeni fighters in the area of designing and enacting battleground operations. Simply put, it should be said that the Emiratis departed from the battleground about 2 years ago and admitted defeat. The Saudis are awaiting the smallest sign on the part of London and Washington, and the latter two themselves are facing a deadlock too. The Sana'a forces are leading a winning strategy which features a gradual approach towards the city. Their scenario comprises laying a siege on the city, either directly or taking it under a barrage of fire. Doing this, they would be leaving the coalition's forces just one outreach pathway through Hadramaut province. The Ma'arib battle signifies greatly, since defeat in it equals the defeat of Mohammed bin Salman's adventurism in Yemen. Moreover, the war has impacted greatly on Saudi Arabia too, because it has caused it to come under successive rocket and drone attacks by Yemen's Ansarullah movement. The war casts a long shadow on Saudi Arabia. However, after the US Deputy Secretary of State Wendy Sherman's trip to Muscat and on a demand made by the Omani side, Yemen's National Salvation Government submitted its initiative for ending the war in Ma'arib province to the Omani diplomatic mission. The initiative is actually the most dangerous one that the Yemenis have put on the table. And if the Saudis and the Americans do not accept it, Ma'arib would be besieged from the direction of the Shabwa province. Here are the provisions of the initiative. One. Formation of a common directorate comprised of Ma'arib locals towards the protection of security and stability, and expulsion of Al-Qaeda and Daesh terrorists from Yemen. 2. Provision of guarantees of freedom of movement, freedom of all the abductees, compensation for those who suffered during the coalition's aggression, return of those who have been displaced and migrated from the province, and an end to aggression on Ma'arib's residents. 3. Allocation of the revenues that are made from exports of oil derivatives from the Hodeidah port to the provision of payment for Ma'arib's people. 4. renewal of the operations of the province's gas power plant, guaranteed commitment to the provision of the other province's share of oil and gas, and formulation of a joint committee tasked with repairing the safer operated Ras Issa oil pipeline. Previously too, Mohammed Abdel Salam, head of Sana'a's negotiating team and Ansar Allah movement spokesman, had told the Al Mayadeen television network, he said, "We came to an agreement with the Omani delegation over the resolution of the humanitarian case. We see no inclination on the part of the enemy coalition's constituent countries towards peace, and it is just the Omani side which has initiated the negotiation process here. Our initiative awaits the approval of the other side. The initiative features agreement on freedom of all those who are captive in Ma'arif province and compensation for those who have suffered. We also agreed on Ma'arif's governance by its own people through an all-inclusive governing body." Abdul Malik al-Ujari, one of Ansar Allah movement's leading figures, has also said previously that the Ansar Allah had assumed that Ma'arif battle would not be easy. "We have not set a timetable for the conflict. The goal is to liberate the city. We take steps towards liberating it, as well as other occupied cities and provinces, from the filth of the occupiers. The Yemeni army and Yemeni popular committees have adopted a military strategy that suits the region's geographical terrain." Moreover, another senior Yemeni official says the country's armies and troops of fighters from allied popular committees will establish full control over the entire district of the central province of Ma'arif in case Saudi-led militants refuse calls for a ceasefire in the strategic area. Ma'arif provincial governor in Yemen's National Salvation Government, Major General Ali Mohammed Tayman, told Lebanon's Arabic language Al Mayadeen television network that the Yemeni army troops and allies are now in control of 85% of the Ma'arif province and are only about 6 to 7 kilometers away from the provincial capital of the same name. General Ali Mohammed Tayman added, "The Yemeni armed forces are currently positioned on the outskirts of Ma'arif city," stressing that, "We agreed to the initiative by the leader of Yemen's popular Ansar Allah resistance movement, Abdul Malik Badr al-Din al-Houthi, for a ceasefire. However, Saudi militants loyal to Yemen's fugitive former president, Abdel Rabbah Mansour Hadi, kept bombing women and children. We want peace and strongly oppose bloodshed." He added, "Houthi's initiative is fair as it involves the locals of Ma'arif in its administration and appropriation of its resources. Such an initiative had not been developed for the past 40 years. We presented the truce initiative from a position of strength." Major General Ali Mohammed Tayman highlighted that he was ready to sit with his counterpart in Abdel Rabbah Mansour Hadi's administration, Major Sultan Al-Arada, either in the Juba district or in Sirwa, in order to discuss the initiative and stop skirmishes in Ma'arif province. He added, "We hope Saudi mercenaries in Ma'arif would agree to Houthi's initiative and quickly implement it if they want to spare the province from war and destruction." The senior Yemeni official noted, "If the mercenaries have the courage to take the decision, we're ready to sit down with them." Major General Tayman said, "While we follow the initiative and are waiting for the other side's actions, no measure has unfortunately been taken yet. Yemeni army forces and fighters from popular committees would not hesitate to liberate the rest of Ma'arif in case Saudi mercenaries turn down the truce initiative. Aid agencies say tens of thousands of Yemenis are in dire need of medical care, have been stranded by the tight Saudi blockade of the country, particularly around Sana'a International Airport. The Norwegian Refugee Council, NRC, and the Cooperative for Assistance and Relief Everywhere, CARE, have reported that 32,000 people in northern Yemen have not been able to travel outside Yemen for potentially life-saving treatment. The Norwegian Refugee Council, NRC's acting country director, Isaac Oko, said, "It's like a hostage situation that has lasted for 5 years. He added, "Patients are trapped in Yemen, even where there is a route to save them. For thousands of sick Yemenis who need urgent medical treatment abroad, these last 5 years have amounted to a death sentence." The Norwegian Refugee Council, NRC, and Assistance and Relief Everywhere, CARE, said the closure of the airport, coupled with Saudi restrictions on goods entering the north of the country through Hodeidah Port, has nearly halted the entry of medicines, medical supplies and equipment, causing prices to soar, making healthcare unaffordable for most Yemenis, and contributing to the unraveling of the healthcare system in the country. Sana'a Airport Director Khaled Al-Shayef said, "There are international demands to open Sana'a Airport as a result of the catastrophic humanitarian repercussions of its continued closure, but the Saudi-dominated coalition countries are still insisting on linking this to other files, including military and political ones." Saudi Arabia, backed by the United States and its regional allies, launched a devastating war on Yemen in March of 2015, with the goal of bringing fugitive President Abdul Rabah Mansour Hadi's government back to power and crushing the popular Ansarullah resistance movement. However, Yemeni armed forces and allied popular committees have gone from strength to strength against the Saudi-led invaders and left Riyadh and its allies bogged down in the country. The war has left hundreds of thousands of Yemenis dead and displaced millions more. It has also destroyed Yemen's infrastructure and spread famine and infectious diseases across the country.
This is A to Z. An introduction to Islamic lifestyle. Today's lesson, Justice in Islam. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In the name of Allah, the Most Beneficent, the Most Merciful. The Quranic concept of justice also extends justice to being a personal virtue and one of the standards of moral excellence that a believer is encouraged to attain as part of his God consciousness. Allah says in chapter 5, verse 8, "Be just, for it is closest to God consciousness." See how beautiful it is, right? Without justice, without being just in our lives, we cannot get to the levels of taqwa that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala expects us. So taqwa, a prerequisite for us to be able to climb up the ladder when it comes to God consciousness or taqwa, is the very concept of justice. So an unjust person who is unjust in his personal life cannot dream to be a God conscious without fixing this vice in his life. This is what we're told through the narrations and through the verses of Quran. Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala even says, "Be conscious of God and be just to your children." See how many times we assume that it's okay, it's just my child, it's just my kid, I can be unjust towards him, right? Just because he's my flesh and blood, you know, that's fine, you know, he's my own.
Well, guess what? Allah is not allowing you to transgress even with your own child, right? Who you are sponsoring, who you're paying for, who you're taking care of, you still cannot be unjust towards that child. The Quran tells the believers in chapter 6, verse number 152, when you speak, speak with justice, even if it is against someone close to you. We're not free to say whatever we feel like it. We have to be just before we open up our mouth. Welcome back to your listeners. Today we are discussing some very personal and private and individualistic level of being just. We said that it's not just, you know, when you go to a courthouse that the topic of justice becomes relevant and important. No, even in our personal lives, at a very small scale, where us being just with our wives, wives being just with their husbands, the parents being just towards their own children, and the children being just towards their own parents. This is how deep this whole concept of justice goes in Islam. Being just towards your elderly parents. Do you think they deserve to just be in a nursing home while you are alive and you can take care of them? Well, this may be something you have to consider if you are wanting to be just. And without justice, rest assured, you cannot get to those levels of taqwa that are destined for you. So if you want to climb up the ladder, be just. Fair dealings in measurements, for instance, and weights, is mentioned in Quran in other passages where justice is, you know, discussed in buying, selling, and by extension to business transactions in general. It is emphasized. There is an entire chapter of Quran, which is chapter 83, I believe, where fraudulent dealers are threatened with divine wrath. In conclusion, to render justice, in the words of a scholar, a noted classic Islamic jurist, ranks as the most noble of acts of devotion next to belief in Allah. It is the greatest of all the duties entrusted to the prophets, and it is the strongest justification for man's stewardship of earth. Dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, thank you very much for staying with us till the end of today's episode of A to Z. Don't forget to log on to our website at parstoday.com, Call of Islam page. We leave you all in the care of Allah. Till next time, wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
This is the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1520 to 1620 UTC on the following frequencies. 41 meters, 7410 kilohertz for Indian subcontinent. And FM 91.5 megahertz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or Badr 5, and via internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.